I was out of sight upon the broad white turnpike. Chapter 21. An Air Scout for Zodanga. As I proceeded on my journey toward Zodanga, many strange and interesting sights arrested my attention, and at the several farmhouses where I stopped, I learned a number of new and instructive things concerning the methods and manners of Barsoom. The water which supplies the farms of Mars is collected in immense underground reservoirs at either pole from the melting ice caps and pumped through long conduits to the various populated centers. Along either side of these conduits, and extending their entire length, lie the cultivated districts. These are divided into tracts of about the same size, each tract being under the supervision of one or more government officers. Instead of flooding the surface of the fields, and thus wasting immense quantities of water by evaporation, the precious liquid is carried underground through a vast network of small pipes directly to the roots of the vegetation. The crops upon Mars are always uniform, for there are no droughts, no rains, no high winds, and no insects or destroying birds. On this trip, I tasted the first meat I had eaten since leaving Earth, large, juicy steaks and chops from the well-fed domestic animals of the farms. Also, I enjoyed luscious fruits and vegetables, but not a single article of food which was exactly similar to anything on Earth. Every plant and flower and vegetable and animal has been so refined by ages of careful, scientific cultivation and breeding that the like of them on Earth dwindled into pale, gray, characterless nothingness by comparison. At a second stop, I met some highly cultivated people of the noble class, and while in conversation, we chanced to speak of helium. One of the older men had been there on a diplomatic mission several years before, and spoke with regret of the conditions which seemed destined ever to keep these two countries of fair-haired people at play. Dejah Thoris clasped her hands with an exclamation of rapture as she gazed upon these magnificent works of art, wrought by a people long extinct, while Sola, on the other hand, apparently did not see them. We decided to use this room on the second floor and overlooking the plaza for Dejah Thoris and Sola, and another room adjoining in the rear for the cooking and supplies. I then dispatched Sola to bring the bedding and such food and utensils as she might need, telling her that I would guard Dejah Thoris until her return. As Sola departed, Dejah Thoris turned to me with a faint smile.
"And where to, then, would your prisoner escape should you leave her, unless it was to follow you and crave your protection, and ask you to pardon for the cruel thoughts she has harbored against you these past few days?"
"You are right," I answered. "There is no escape for either of us, unless we go together."
"I heard your challenge to the creature you call Tars Tarkas, and I think I understand your position among these people. But what I cannot fathom is your statement that you are not of Barsoom."
"In the name of my first ancestor, then," she continued, "where may you be from? You are like unto my people, and yet so unlike. You speak my language, and yet I heard you tell Tars Tarkas that you had but learned it recently. All Barsoomians speak the same tongue, from the ice-clad south to the ice-clad north, though their written languages differ. Only in the Valley Dor, where the river Iss empties into the lost sea of Chorus, is there supposed to be a different language spoken, and, except in the legends of our ancestors, there is no record of a Barsoomian returning up the river Iss from the shores of Chorus in the Valley of Dor. Do not tell me that you have thus returned. They would kill you horribly anywhere upon the surface of Barsoom, if that were true. Tell me it is not."
Her eyes were filled with a strange, weird light. Her voice was pleading, and her little hands reached up from head to foot, and from head to foot I was clothed, though when I fell unconscious at the little doorway, I had been naked. Before me was a small patch of moonlit sky, which showed through a ragged aperture. As my hands passed over my body, they came in contact with pockets, and in one of these a small parcel of matches wrapped in oiled paper. One of these matches I struck, and its dim flame lighted up what appeared to be a huge cave, toward the back of which I discovered a strange, still figure huddled over a tiny bench. As I approached it, I saw that it was the dead and mummified remains of a little old woman with long black hair, and the thing it leaned over was a small charcoal burner upon which rested a round copper vessel containing a small quantity of greenish powder. Behind her, depending from the roof upon rawhide thongs, and stretching entirely across the cave, was a row of human skeletons. From the thong which held them stretched another to the dead hand of the little old woman. As I touched the cord, the skeleton swung to the motion with a noise as of the rustling of dry leaves. It was a most grotesque and horrid tableau, and I hastened out into the fresh air, glad to escape from so gruesome a place. The sight that met my eyes as I stepped out upon a small ledge which ran before the entrance of the cave filled me with consternation. A new heaven and a new landscape met my gaze. The silvered mountains in the distance, the almost stationary moon hanging in the sky, the cacti-studded valley below me were not of Mars. I could scarcely believe my eyes, but the truth slowly forced itself upon me. I was looking upon Arizona from the same ledge from which 10 years before I had gazed with longing upon Mars. Bearing my head in my arms, I turned, broken and sorrowful, down the trail from the cave. Above me shone the red eye of Mars, holding her awful filled me, I must confess, with dire forebodings. I am ever willing to stand and fight when the odds are not too overwhelmingly against me, but in this instance I perceived neither glory nor profit in pitting my relatively puny strength against the iron muscles and brutal ferocity of this enraged denizen of an unknown world. In fact, the only outcome of such an encounter, so far as I might be concerned, seemed sudden death. I was standing near the window, and I knew that once in the street I might gain the plaza in safety before the creature could overtake me. At least there was a chance for safety in flight, against almost certain death, should I remain and fight however desperately. It is true I held the cudgel, but what could I do with it against his four great arms? Even should I break one of them with my first blow, for I figured that he would attempt to ward off the cudgel, he could reach out and annihilate me with the others before I could recover for a second attack. In the instant that these thoughts passed through my mind, I had turned to make for the window, but my eyes, alighting on the form of my erstwhile guardian, threw all thoughts of flight to the four winds. He lay gasping upon the floor of the chamber, his great eyes fastened upon me in what seemed a pitiful appeal for protection. I could not withstand that look, nor could I, on second thought, have deserted my rescuer without giving as good an account of myself in his behalf as he had in mine. Without more ado, therefore, I turned to meet the charge of the infuriated bull ape. He was now too close upon me for the cudgel to prove of any effective assistance, so I merely threw it as heavily as I could at his advancing bulk. It struck him just below the knees, eliciting a howl of pain and rage, and so throwing him off his balance that he lunged full upon me with arms wide stretched to ease his fall. Again, as on the preceding grit, 48 million miles away. Did the Martian reach the pump room? Did the vitalizing air reach the people of that distant planet in time to save them? Was my Dejah Thoris alive, or did her beautiful body lie cold in death beside the tiny golden incubator in the sunken garden of the inner courtyard of the palace of Tardos Mors, the Jeddak of Helium? For 10 years I have waited and prayed for an answer to my questions. For 10 years I have waited and prayed to be taken back to the world of my lost love. I would rather lie dead beside her there than live on earth all those millions of terrible miles from her. The old mine which I found untouched has made me fabulously wealthy, but what care I for wealth? As I sit here tonight in my little study overlooking the Hudson, just 20 years have elapsed since I first opened my eyes upon Mars. I can see her shining in the sky through the little window by my desk, and tonight she seems calling to me again as she has not called before since that long dead night, and I think I can see, across that awful abyss of space, a beautiful black-haired woman standing in the garden of the palace, and at her side is a little boy who puts his arm around her as she points into the sky toward the planet Earth, while at their feet is a huge and hideous creature with a heart of gold. I believe that they are waiting there for me, and something tells me that I shall soon know. This concludes A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Return with John Carter back to the Martian planet in the next Martian tale, The Gods of Mars, also produced by Tantor Media. In the sequel, John Carter joins forces with old comrades and forms new lifetime alliances as he battles hostile enemies previously unknown to his people of Barsoom. His adventures ultimately reveal the truth about the gods of Mars. Please visit our website.
War. Helium, he said, rightly boasts the most beautiful women of Barsoom, and of all her treasures, the wondrous daughter of Mos Karjak, Deja Thoris, is the most exquisite flower. By, he added, the people really worship the ground she walks upon, and since her loss on that ill-starred expedition, all Helium has been draped in mourning. That our ruler should have attacked the disabled fleet as it was returning to Helium was but another of his awful blunders, which I fear will sooner or later compel Zadanga to elevate a wiser man to his place. Even now, though our victorious armies are surrounding Helium, the people of Zadanga are voicing their displeasure, for the war is not a popular one, since it is not based on right or justice. Our forces took advantage of the absence of the principal fleet of Helium on their search for the princess, and so he have been able easily to reduce the city to a sorry plight. It is said she will fall within the next few passages of the further moon.
And what, thank you, may have been the fate of the Princess Deja Thoris? I asked as casually as possible.
She is dead, he answered. This much was learned from a green warrior recently captured by our forces in the south. She escaped from the hordes of Thark with a strange creature of another world, only to fall into the hands of the Wahoons. Their thoughts were found wandering upon the sea bottom, and evidences of a bloody conflict were discovered nearby. While this information was in no way reassuring, neither was it at all conclusive proof of the death of Deja Thoris, and so I determined to make every effort possible to reach Helium as quickly as I could, and carry to Tardos Mors such news of his granddaughter's possible whereabouts as lay in my power. 10 days after leaving the three Tor brothers, I arrived at Zadanga. From the moment that I had come in contact with the red inhabitants of Mars, I had noticed that Wooler drew a great amount of unwelcome attention to me. Since the huge brute lay, I had recourse to earthly tactics, and swinging my right fist full upon the point of his chin, I followed it with a smashing left to the pit of his stomach. The effect was marvelous, for, as I lightly sidestepped, after delivering the second blow, he reeled and fell upon the floor, doubled up with pain and gasping for wind. Leaping over his prostrate body, I seized the cudgel and finished the monster before he could regain his feet. As I delivered the blow, a low laugh rang out behind me, and turning, I beheld Tars Tarkas, Sola, and three or four warriors standing in the doorway of the chamber. As my eyes met theirs, I was, for the second time, the recipient of their zealously guarded applause. My absence had been noted by Sola on her awakening, and she had quickly informed Tars Tarkas, who had set out immediately with a handful of warriors to search for me. As they had approached the limits of the city, they had witnessed the actions of the bull ape as he bolted into the building, frothing with rage. They had followed immediately behind him, thinking it barely possible that his actions might prove a clue to my whereabouts, and had witnessed my short but decisive battle with him. This encounter, together with my set-to with the Martian warrior on the previous day, and my feats of jumping, placed me upon a high pinnacle in their regard. Evidently devoid of all the finer sentiments of friendship, love, or affection, these people fairly worship physical prowess and bravery, and nothing is too good for the object of their adoration as long as he maintains his position by repeated examples of his skill, strength, and courage.
Sola, who had accompanied the search party of her own volition, was the only one of the Martians whose face had not been twisted in laughter as I battled for my life. She, on the contrary, was sober with apparent solicitude, and as soon as I had finished the monster, rushed to me, and kept on my breast, were pressed against me, as though to wring a denial from my very heart. "I do not know your customs, Dasia Thoris, but in my own Virginia a gentleman does not lie to save himself. I am not of Dor. I have never seen the mysterious Iss. The lost sea, of course, is still lost, so far as I am concerned. Do you believe me?" And then it struck me suddenly that I was very anxious that she should believe me. It was not that I feared the results which would follow a general belief that I had returned from the Barsoomian heaven or hell, or whatever it was. Why was it, then? Why should I care what she thought? I looked down at her, her beautiful face upturned, and her wonderful eyes opening up the very depth of her soul, and as my eyes met hers, I knew why, and I shuddered. A similar wave of feeling seemed to stir her. She drew away from me with a sigh, and with her earnest, beautiful face turned up to mine, she whispered, "I believe you, John Carter. I do not know what a gentleman is, nor have I ever. He does not wish to speak the truth, he is silent. Where is this Virginia, your country, John Carter?" she asked, and it seemed that this fair name of my fair land had never sounded more beautiful than as it fell from those perfect lips on that far-gone day. "I am of another world," I answered, "the great planet Earth, which revolves about our common sun, and next within the orbit of your Barsoom, which we know as Mars. How I came here, I cannot tell you, for I do not know, but here I am, and since my presence has permitted me to serve Dasia Thoris, I am glad that I am here." She gazed at me with troubled eyes, long and questioningly. That it was difficult to believe my statement I well knew, nor could I hope that she would do so, however much I craved her confidence and respect. I would much rather not have told her anything of my antecedents, but no man could look into the depth of those eyes and refuse her slightest behest. She examined my body for possible wounds or injuries. Satisfying herself that I had come off unscathed, she smiled quietly, and taking my hand, started toward the door of the chamber. Tars Tarkas and the other warriors had entered and were standing over the now rapidly reviving brute which had saved my life and whose life I, in turn, had rescued. They seemed to be deep in argument, and finally one of them addressed me, but remembering my ignorance of his language, turned back to Tars Tarkas, who, with a word and gesture, gave some command to the fellow and turned to follow us from the room. There seemed something menacing in their attitude toward my beast, and I hesitated to leave until I learned the outcome. It was well I did so, for the warrior drew an evil-looking pistol from its holster and was on the point of putting an end to the creature when I sprang forward and struck his arm. The bullet striking the wooden casing of the window exploded, blowing a hole completely through the wood and masonry. I then knelt down beside the fearsome-looking thing, and raising it to its feet, motioned for it to follow me. The looks of surprise which my actions elicited from the Martians were ludicrous. They could not understand, except in a feeble and childish way, such attributes as gratitude and compassion. The warrior, whose gun I had struck up, looked inquiringly at Tars Tarkas, but the latter signed that I be left to my own devices, and so we returned to the plaza with my great beast following close at heel, and Sola grasping me tightly by the arm. I had at least two friends on Mars, a young woman who watched over me with motherly solicitude, and a dumb brute which, as I later came to know, held in its poor ugly carcass more love, more loyalty, more gratitude than could have been found in the entire 5 million green Martians who roved the deserted cities and dead sea bottoms of Mars. Finally, she smiled and rising said, "I shall have to believe, even though I cannot understand. I can readily perceive that you are not of the Barsoom of today. You are like us, yet different. But why should I trouble my poor head with such a problem,
when my heart tells me that I believe because I wish to believe."
It was good logic, good earthly feminine logic, and if it satisfied her, I certainly could pick no flaws in it. As a matter of fact, it was about the only kind of logic that could be brought to bear upon my problem. We fell into a general conversation then, asking and answering many questions on each side. She was curious to learn of the customs of my people, and displayed a remarkable knowledge of events on earth. When I questioned her closely on this seeming familiarity with earthly things, she laughed and cried out,
"Why, every schoolboy on Barsoom knows the geography and much concerning the fauna and flora, as well as the history of your planet fully as well as of his own. Can we not see everything which takes place upon earth, as you call it? Is it not hanging there in the heavens in plain sight?"
This baffled me, I must confess, fully as much as my statements had confounded her, and I told her so. She then explained in general the instruments her people had used and been perfecting for ages, which permit them to throw upon a screen a perfect image of what is transpiring upon any planet and upon many other stars. These pictures are so perfect in detail that when photographed and enlarged, objects no greater than a blade of grass may be distinctly recognized. I afterward, in Helium, saw many of these pictures, as well as the instruments which produced them.
"If, then, you are so familiar with earthly things," I asked, "why is it that you do not recognize me as identical with the inhabitants of that planet?"
She smiled again, as one might in bored indulgence of a questioning child.
"Because, John Carter," she replied, "nearly every planet and star having atmospheric conditions..."
www.tantor.com for our growing library of inspiring unabridged classics by renowned authors. We also welcome you to sample all our titles, listen to author biographies, and take advantage of special offers at www.tantor.com or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog. We hope you have enjoyed this Tantor Media presentation.
At all approaching those of Barsoom, shows forms of animal life almost identical with you and me. And further, Earthmen, almost without exception, cover their bodies with strange, unsightly pieces of cloth, and their heads with hideous contraptions, the purpose of which we have been unable to conceive, while you, when found by the Tharkian warriors, were entirely undisfigured and unadorned. The fact that you wore no ornaments is a strong proof of your un-Barsoomian origin, while the absence of grotesque coverings might cause a doubt as to your earthliness.
I then narrated the details of my departure from the earth, explaining that my body there lay fully clothed in all the, to her, strange garments of mundane dwellers. At this point Sola returned with our meager belongings and her young Martian protege, who, of course, would have to share the quarters with them. Sola asked us if we had had a visitor during her absence, and seemed much surprised when we answered in the negative. It seemed that, as she had mounted the approach to the upper floors where our quarters were located, she had met Sarkoja descending. We decided that she must have been eavesdropping, but as we could recall nothing of importance that had passed between us, we dismissed the matter as of little consequence, merely promising ourselves to be warned to the utmost caution in the future. Dejathoris and I then fell to examining the architecture and decorations of the beautiful chambers of the building we were occupying. She told me that these people had presumably flourished over 100,000 years before. They were the early progenitors of her race, but had mixed with the other great race of early Martians, who were very dark, almost black, and also with the reddish-yellow race, which had flourished at the same time. These three great divisions of the higher Martians had been forced into a mighty alliance as the drying up of the Martian seas had compelled them to seek the comparatively few and always diminishing fertile areas, and to defend to a species which is never domesticated by the red men. Were one to stroll down Broadway with a Numidian lion at his heels, the effect would be somewhat similar to that which I should have produced had I entered Zadanga with Woola. The very thought of parting with the faithful fellow caused me so great regret and genuine sorrow that I put it off until just before we arrived at the city's gates, but then finally it became imperative that we separate. Had nothing further than my own safety or pleasure been at stake, no argument could have prevailed upon me to turn away the one creature upon Barsoom that had never failed in a demonstration of affection and loyalty. But as I would willingly have offered my life in the service of her in search of whom I was about to challenge the unknown dangers of this, to me, mysterious city, I could not permit even Woolla's life to threaten the success of my venture, much less his momentary happiness, for I doubted not he soon would forget me. And so I bade the poor beast an affectionate farewell, promising him, however, that if I came through my adventure in safety, that in some way I should find the means to search him out. He seemed to understand me fully, and when I pointed back in the direction of Thark, he turned sorrowfully away, nor could I bear to watch him go, but resolutely set my face towards Adanga, and with a touch of heartsickness approached her frowning walls. The letter I bore from them gained me immediate entrance to the vast walled city. It was still very early in the morning, and the streets were practically deserted. The residences, raised high upon their metal columns, resembled huge rookeries, while the uprights themselves presented the appearance of steel tree trunks. The shops, as a rule, were not raised from the ground, nor were their doors bolted or barred, since thievery is practically unknown upon Barsoom. Assassination is the ever-present fear of all Barsoomians, and for this reason alone their homes are raised high above the ground at night or in times of danger, themselves, under new conditions of life, against the wild hordes of green men. Ages of close relationship and intermarrying had resulted in the race of red men, of which Dejah Thoris was a fair and beautiful daughter. During the ages of hardships and incessant warring between their own various races, as well as with the green men, and before they had fitted themselves to the changed conditions, much of the high civilization and many of the arts of the fair-haired Martians had become lost. But the red race of today has reached a point where it feels that it has made up in new discoveries and in a more practical civilization for all that lies irretrievably buried with the ancient Barsoomians beneath the countless intervening ages. These ancient Martians had been a highly cultivated and literary race, but during the vicissitudes of those trying centuries of readjustment to new conditions, not only did their advancement and production cease entirely, but practically all their archives, records, and literature were lost. Dejah Thoris related many interesting facts and legends concerning this lost race of noble and kindly people. She said that the city in which we were camping was supposed to have been a center of commerce and culture known as Korad. It had been built upon a beautiful natural harbor, landlocked by magnificent hills. The little valley on the west front of the city, she explained, was all that remained of the harbor. While the pass through the hills to the old sea bottom had been the channel through which the shipping passed up to the city gates. The shores of the ancient seas were dotted with just such cities, and lesser ones, in diminishing numbers, were to be found converging toward the center of the oceans, as the people had found it necessary to follow the receding waters until necessity had forced upon them their ultimate salvation, the so-called Martian canals. We had been so engrossed in exploration of the building and in our conversation that it was late in the afternoon before we realized it. We were brought back to a realization of our present conditions by a messenger bearing a summons from Lorcus Tomal directing me to appear before him forthwith. Bidding Dejah Thoris and Sola farewell, and commanding Woolla to remain on guard, I hastened to the audience chamber, where I found Lorcus Tomal and Taj Tarkas seated upon the rostrum. Chapter 12. A Prisoner with Power. As I entered and saluted, Lorcus Tomal signaled me to advance, and fixing his great hideous eyes upon me, addressed me thus.
You have been with us a few days, yet during that time you have by your prowess won a high position among us. Be that as it may, you are not one of us. You owe us no allegiance. Your position is a peculiar one, he continued. You are a prisoner, and yet you give commands which must be obeyed. You are an alien, and yet you are a Tharkian chieftain. You are a midget, and yet you can kill a mighty warrior with one blow of your fist. And now you are reported to have been plotting to escape with another prisoner of another race, a prisoner who, from her own admission, half believes you are returned from the Valley of Dor. Either one of these accusations, if proved, would be sufficient grounds for your execution. But we are just people, and you shall have a trial on our return to Thark, if Tal-Hajis so commands. But, he continued in his fierce guttural tones, if you run off with the Red Girl, it is I who shall have to account to Tal-Hajis. It is I who shall have to face Tars-Takis, and either demonstrate my right to command, or the metal from my dead carcass will go to a better man, for such is the custom of the Tharks. I have no quarrel with Tars-Takis. Together we rule supreme the greatest of the lesser communities among the green men. We do not wish to fight between ourselves, and so if you were dead, John Carter, I should be glad. Under two conditions only, however, may you be killed by us without orders from Tal-Hajis, and
The Tor brothers had given me explicit directions for reaching the point of the city where I could find living accommodations and be near the offices of the government agents to whom they had given me letters. My way led to the central square or plaza, which is a characteristic of all Martian cities. The plaza of Zadanga covers a square mile and is bounded by the palaces of the Jeddak, the Jeds, and other members of the royalty and nobility of Zadanga, as well as by the principal public buildings, cafes, and shops. As I was crossing the great square, lost in wonder and admiration of the magnificent architecture and the gorgeous scarlet vegetation which carpeted the broad lawns, I discovered a red Martian walking briskly toward me from one of the avenues. He paid not the slightest attention to me, but as he came abreast, I recognized him, and turning, I placed my hand upon his shoulder, calling out,
"Kaor, Kantis Khan!" Like lightning, he wheeled, and before I could so much as lower my hand, the point of his longsword was at my breast. "Who are you?" he growled, and then as a backward leap carried me 50 feet from his sword, he dropped the point to the ground and exclaimed, laughing, "I do not need a better reply. There is but one man upon all Barsoom who can bounce about like a rubber ball. By the mother of the further moon, John Carter, how came you here? And have you become a Darsene that you can change your color at will?" "You gave me a bad half-minute, my friend," he continued after I had briefly outlined my adventures since parting with him in the arena at Warhoon. "Were my name and city known to the Zadangans, I would shortly be sitting on the banks of the Lost Sea of Chorus with my revered and departed ancestors. I am here in the interest of Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium, to discover the whereabouts of Deja Thoris, our princess. Sabthan, Prince of Zodanga, has her hidden in the city and has fallen madly in love with her. His father, Thankosis, Jeddak of Zodanga, has made her voluntary marriage for combat and self-defense. Should you attack one of us, or were you apprehended in an attempt to escape? As a matter of justice, I must warn you that we only await one of these two excuses for ridding ourselves of so great a responsibility. The safe delivery of the Red Girl to Tal-Hajis is of the greatest importance. Not in 1,000 years have the Tharks made such a capture. She is the granddaughter of the greatest of the Red Jeddaks, who is also our bitterest enemy. I have spoken. The Red Girl told us that we were without the softer sentiments of humanity, but we are a just and truthful race. You may go." Turning, I left the audience chamber. So this was the beginning of Sarkoja's persecution. I knew that none other could be responsible for this report, which had reached the ears of Lorcus Tomal so quickly. And now I recalled those portions of our conversation which had touched upon escape and upon my origin. Sarkoja was at this time Tartaka's oldest and most trusted female. As such, she was a mighty power behind the throne, for no warrior had the confidence of Lorcus Tomal to such an extent as did his ablest lieutenant, Tars-Takis. However, instead of putting thoughts of possible escape from my mind, my audience with Lorcus Tomal only served to center my every faculty on this subject. Now, more than before, the absolute necessity for escape,
insofar as Dejah Thoris was concerned, was impressed upon me, for I was convinced that some horrible fate awaited her at the headquarters of Tal Hagis. As described by Sola, this monster was the exaggerated personification of all the ages of cruelty, ferocity, and brutality from which he had descended. Cold, cunning, calculating, he was also, in marked contrast to most of his fellows, a slave to that brute passion which the waning demands for procreation upon their dying planet has almost stilled in the Martian breast. Chapter 7. Child Raising on Mars. After a breakfast, which was an exact replica of the meal of the preceding day, and an index of practically every meal which followed while I was with the green men of Mars, Sola escorted me to the plaza, where I found the entire community engaged in watching or helping at the harnessing of huge Macedonian animals to great three-wheeled chariots. There were about 250 of these vehicles, each drawn by a single animal, any one of which, from their appearance, might easily have drawn the entire wagon train when fully loaded. The chariots themselves were large, commodious, and gorgeously decorated. In each was seated a female Martian loaded with ornaments of metal, with jewels and silks and furs, and upon the back of each of the beasts which drew the chariots was perched a young Martian driver. Like the animals upon which the warriors were mounted, the heavier draft animals wore neither bit nor bridle, but were guided entirely by telepathic beings. This power is wonderfully developed in all Martians, and accounts largely for the simplicity of their language and the relatively few spoken words exchanged even in long conversations. It is the universal language of Mars, through the medium of which the higher and lower animals of this world of paradoxes are able to communicate to a greater or less extent, depending upon the intellectual sphere of the species and the development of the individual. As the cavalcade took up the line of march in single file, Sola dragged me into an empty chariot, and we proceeded with the procession toward the point by which I had entered the city the day before. At the head of the caravan rode some 200 warriors, 5 abreast, and a like number brought up the rear, while 25 or 30 outriders flanked us on either side. Every one but myself, men, women, and children, were heavily armed, and at the tail of each chariot trotted a Martian hound, much to his son, the price of peace between our countries. But Tartus Mors will not accede to the demands, and has sent word that he and his people would rather look upon the dead face of their princess than see her wed to any than her own choice, and that personally he would prefer being engulfed in the ashes of a lost and burning helium to joining the metal of his house with that of Thon Kosis. His reply was the deadliest affront he could have put upon Thon Kosis and the Zodongans, but his people love him the more for it, and his strength in helium is greater today than ever. "I have been here 3 days," continued Kartos Khan, "but I have not yet found where Dejah Thoris is imprisoned. Today I joined the Zodongan navy as an air scout, and I hope in this way to win the confidence of Sarthan, the prince, who is commander of this division of the navy, and thus learned the whereabouts of Dejah Thoris. I am glad that you are here, John Carter, for I know your loyalty to my princess, and two of us working together should be able to accomplish much." The plaza was now commencing to fill with people going and coming upon the daily activities of their duties. The shops were opening, and the cafes filling with early morning patrons. Kartos Khan led me to one of these gorgeous eating places, where we were served entirely by mechanical apparatus. No hand touched the food from the time it entered the building in its raw state until it emerged hot and delicious upon the tables before the guest, in response to the touching of tiny buttons to indicate their desires. After our meal, Kartos Khan took me with him to the headquarters of the Air Scout Squadron, and introducing me to his superior, asked that I be enrolled as a member of the corps. In accordance with custom, an examination was necessary, but Kartos Khan had told me to have no fear on this score, as he would attend to that part of the matter. He accomplished this by taking my order for examination to the examining officer, and represented
The thought that the divine Dejathoris might fall into the clutches of such an abysmal atavism started the cold sweat upon me. Far better that we save friendly bullets for ourselves at the last moment, as did those brave frontier women of my lost land, who took their own lives rather than fall into the hands of the Indian braves. As I wandered about the plaza, lost in my gloomy forebodings, Tars Tarkas approached me on his way from the audience chamber. His demeanor toward me was unchanged, and he greeted me as though we had not just parted a few moments before.
"Where are your quarters, John Carter?" he asked.
"I have selected none," I replied. "It seemed best that I quartered either by myself or among the other warriors, and I was awaiting an opportunity to ask your advice. As you know," and I smiled, "I am not yet familiar with all the customs of the Tharks."
"Come with me," he directed, and together we moved off across the plaza to a building which I was glad to see adjoined that occupied by Sola and her charges. "My quarters are on the first floor of this building," he said, "and the second floor also is fully occupied by warriors, but the third floor and the floors above are vacant. You may take your choice of these." "I understand," he continued, "that you have given up your woman to the Red Prisoner. Well, as you have said, your ways are not our ways, but you can fight well enough to do about as you please. And so, if you wish to give your woman to a captive, it is your own affair. But as a chieftain, you should have those to serve you, and in accordance with our customs, you may select any of all the females from the retinues of the chieftains whose metal you now wear."
I thanked him, but assured him that I could get along very nicely without assistance except in the matter of preparing food, and so he promised to send women to me for this purpose, and also for the care of my arms and the manufacture of my ammunition, which he said would be necessary. I suggested that they might also bring their own beasts, following closely behind ours. In fact, the faithful creature never left me voluntarily during the entire 10 years I spent on Mars. Our way led out across the little valley before the city, through the hills, and down into the Dead Sea bottom which I had traversed on my journey from the incubator to the plaza. The incubator, as it proved, was the terminal point of our journey this day, and as the entire cavalcade broke into a mad gallop, as soon as we reached the level expanse of sea bottom, we were soon within sight of our goal. On reaching it, the chariots were parked with military precision on the four sides of the enclosure, and half a score of warriors, headed by the enormous chieftain, and including Tars Tarkas and several other lesser chiefs, dismounted and advanced toward it. I could see Tars Tarkas explaining something to the principal chieftain, whose name, by the way, was, as nearly as I can translate it into English, Lorquas Tomal Jed, Jed being his title. I was soon appraised of the subject of their conversation as, calling to Sola, Tars Tarkas signed for her to send me to him. I had by this time mastered the intricacies of walking under Martian conditions, and quickly responding to his command, I advanced to the side of the incubator where the warrior stood. As I reached their side, a glance showed me that all but a very few eggs had hatched, the incubator being fairly alive with the hideous little devils. They ranged in height from 3 to 4 feet, and were moving restlessly about the enclosure as though searching for food. As I came to a halt before him, Tars Tarkas pointed over the incubator and said, "Sack." I saw that he wanted me to repeat my performance of yesterday for the edification of Lorquas Tomal, and as I must confess that my prowess gave me no little satisfaction, I responded quickly, leaping entirely over the parked chariots on the far side of the incubator. As I returned, looking himself as John Carter.
"This ruse will be discovered later," he cheerfully explained, "when they check up my weights, measurements, and other personal identification data. But it will be several months before this is done, and our mission should be accomplished or have failed long before that time."
The next few days were spent by Kantos Khan in teaching me the intricacies of flying and of repairing the dainty little contrivances which the Martians use for this purpose. The body of the one-man aircraft is about 16 feet long, 2 feet wide, and 3 inches thick, tapering to a point at each end. The driver sits on top of this plane upon a seat constructed over the small, noiseless radium engine which propels it. The medium of buoyancy is contained within the thin metal walls of the body and consists of the eighth Barsoomian ray, or ray of propulsion as it may be termed in view of its properties. This ray, like the ninth ray, is unknown on Earth, but the Martians have discovered that it is an inherent property of all light, no matter from what source it emanates. They have learned that it is the solar eighth ray which propels the light of the sun to the various planets, and that it is the individual eighth ray of each planet which reflects or propels the light thus obtained out into space once more. The solar eighth ray would be absorbed by the surface of Barsoom, but the Barsoomian eighth ray, which tends to propel light from Mars into space, is constantly streaming out from the planet, constituting a force of repulsion of gravity, which, when confined, is able to lift enormous weights from the surface of the ground.
Some of the sleeping silks and furs which belonged to me as spoils of combat, for the nights were cold, and I had none of my own.
He promised to do so, and departed. Left alone, I ascended the winding corridor to the upper floors in search of suitable quarters. The beauties of the other buildings were repeated in this, and as usual, I was soon lost in a tour of investigation and discovery. I finally chose a front room on the third floor, because this brought me nearer to Dejah Thoris, whose apartment was on the second floor of the adjoining building, and it flashed upon me that I could rig up some means of communication whereby she might signal me in case she needed either my services or my protection. Adjoining my sleeping apartments were baths, dressing rooms, and other sleeping and living apartments, in all some 10 rooms on this floor. The windows of the back rooms overlooked an enormous court, which formed the center of the square made by the buildings which faced the 4 contiguous streets, and which was now given over to the quartering of the various animals belonging to the warriors occupying the adjoining buildings. While the court was entirely overgrown with the yellow, moss-like vegetation which blankets practically the entire surface of Mars, yet numerous fountains, statuary, benches, and pergola-like contraptions bore witness to the beauty which the court must have presented in bygone times, when graced by the fair-haired, laughing people whom stern and unalterable cosmic laws had driven not only from their homes, but from all except the vague legends of their descendants. One could easily picture the gorgeous foliage of the luxuriant Martian vegetation which once filled this scene with life and color, the graceful figures of the beautiful women, the straight and handsome men, the happy, frolicking children, all sunlight, happiness, and peace. It was difficult to realize that they had gone, down through the ages of darkness, cruelty, and ignorance, until their hereditary Tomal grunted something at me, and turning to his warriors gave a few words of command relative to the incubator. They paid no further attention to me, and I was thus permitted to remain close and watch their operations, which consisted in breaking an opening in the wall of the incubator large enough to permit of the exit of the young Martians. On either side of this opening, the women and the younger Martians, both male and female, formed 2 solid walls leading out through the chariots and quite away into the plain beyond. Between these walls the little Martians scampered, wild as deer, being permitted to run the full length of the aisle, where they were captured one at a time by the women and older children, the last in line capturing the first little one to reach the end of the gauntlet, her opposite in the line capturing the second, and so on until all the little fellows had left the enclosure and had been appropriated by some youth or female. As the women caught the young, they fell out of line and returned to their respective chariots, while those who fell into the hands of the young men were later turned over to some of the women. I saw that the ceremony, if it could be dignified by such a name, was over, and seeking out Sola, I found her in our chariot with a hideous little creature held tightly in her arms. The work of rearing green young Martians consists solely in teaching them to talk, and to use the weapons of warfare with which they are loaded down from the very first year of their lives. Coming from eggs in which they have lain for 5 years, the period of incubation,
They step forth into the world perfectly developed except in size, entirely unknown to their mothers, who in turn would have difficulty in pointing out the fathers with any degree of accuracy. They are the common children of the community, and their education devolves upon the females who chance to capture them as they leave the incubator. Their foster mothers may not even have had an egg in the incubator, as was the case with Sola, who had not commenced to lay until less than a year before she became the mother of another woman's offspring. But this counts for little among the Green Martians, as parental and filial love is as unknown to them as it is common among us. I believe this horrible system, which has been carried on for ages, is the direct cause of the loss of all the finer feelings and higher humanitarian instincts among these poor creatures. From birth, they know no father or mother love. They know not the meaning of the word home. They are taught that they are only suffered to live until they can demonstrate by their physique and ferocity that they are fit to live. Should they prove deformed or defective in any way, they are promptly shot. Nor do they see a tear shed for a single one of the many cruel hardships they pass through from earliest infancy. I do not mean that the adult Martians are unnecessarily or intentionally cruel to the young, but theirs is a hard and pitiless struggle for existence upon a dying planet, the natural resources of which have dwindled to a point where the support of each additional life means an added tax upon the community into which it is thrown. By careful selection, they rear only the hardiest specimens of each species, and with almost supernatural foresight they regulate the birth rate to merely offset the loss by death. Each adult Martian female brings forth about 13 eggs each year, and those which meet the size, weight, and specific gravity test are hidden in the recesses of some subterranean vault where the temperature is too low for incubation. Every year these eggs are carefully examined by a council of 20 chieftains, and all but about 100 of the most perfect are destroyed out of each yearly supply. At the end of 5 years, about 500 almost perfect eggs have been chosen from the thousands brought forth. These are then placed in the almost airtight incubators to be hatched by the sun's rays after a period of another 5 years. The hatching which we had witnessed today was a fairly representative event of its kind, all but about 1% of the eggs hatching in 2 days. Instincts of culture and humanitarianism had risen ascendant once more in the final composite race which now is dominant upon Mars. My thoughts were cut short by the advent of several young females bearing loads of weapons, silks, furs, jewels, cooking utensils, and casks of food and drink, including considerable loot from the aircraft. All this, it seemed, had been the property of the two chieftains I had slain, and now, by the customs of the Tharks, it had become mine. At my direction, they placed the stuff in one of the back rooms, and then departed, only to return with the second load, which they advised me constituted the balance of my goods. On the second trip, they were accompanied by 10 or 15 other women in use, who, it seemed, formed the retinues of the two chieftains.
They were not their families, nor their wives, nor their servants. Their relationship was peculiar, and so unlike anything known to us that it is most difficult to describe. All property among the Green Martians is owned in common by the community, except the personal weapons, ornaments, and sleeping silks and furs of the individuals. These alone can one claim undisputed right to, nor may he accumulate more of these than are required for his actual needs. The surplus he holds merely as custodian, and it is passed on to the younger members of the community as necessity demands.
The women and children of a man's retinue may be likened to a military unit, for which he is responsible in various ways, as in matters of instruction, discipline, sustenance, and the exigencies of their continual roamings and their unending strife with other communities and with the Red Martians. His women are in no sense wives. The Green Martians use no word corresponding in meaning with this earthly word. Their mating is a matter of community interest solely, and is directed without reference to natural selection. The council of chieftains of each
to work backwards. Was it possibly the root of all evil? No, Of course, the love of money was called that. But money itself, perhaps one valued it chiefly as a defence against chance, a security for being able to have things over again, a means of arresting the unrolling of the film. He was startled from his meditation by the physical discomfort of some weight on his knees. The dragon had lain down and deposited its long, heavy head across them. "Do you know," he said to it in English, "that you are a considerable nuisance?" It never moved. He decided that he had better try and make friends with it. He stroked the hard, dry head, but the creature took no notice. Then his hand passed lower down and found softer surface, or even a chink in the mail. Ah, that was where it liked being tickled. It grunted and shot out a long, cylindrical, slate-coloured tongue to lick him. It rolled round on its back, revealing an almost white belly, which Ransom kneaded with his toes. His acquaintance with the dragon prospered exceedingly. In the end, it went to sleep. He rose and got a second shower from a bubble tree. This made him feel so fresh and alert that he began to think of food. He had forgotten whereabouts on the island the yellow gourds were to be found, and as he set out to look for them, he discovered that it was difficult to walk. For a moment he wondered whether the liquid in the bubbles had some intoxicating quality, but a glance around assured him of the real reason. The plain of copper-coloured heather before him, even as he watched, swelled into a low hill, and the low hill moved in his direction. Spellbound anew at the sight of land rolling towards him, like water in a wave, he forgot to adjust himself to the movement and lost his feet. Picking himself up, he proceeded more carefully. This time there was no doubt about it, the sea was rising. Where two neighbouring woods made a vista to the edge of this living raft, he could see troubled water, and the warm wind was now strong enough to ruffle his hair. He made his way gingerly towards the coast, but before he reached it he passed some bushes which carried a rich crop of oval green berries, about three times the size of almonds. He picked one and broke it in two. The flesh was dryish and bread-like, something of the same kind as a banana. It turned out to be good to eat. It did not give the orgiastic and almost alarming pleasure of the gourds, but rather the specific pleasure of plain food, the delight of munching and being nourished, a sober certainty of waking bliss. A man, or at least a man like Ransom, felt he ought to say grace over it, and so he presently did. The gourds would have required rather an oratorio or a mystical meditation. But the meal had its unexpected highlights. Every now and then one struck a berry which had a bright red centre, and these were so savoury, so memorable among a thousand tastes, that he would have begun to look for them and to feed on them only, but that he was once more forbidden by that same inner adviser which had already spoken to him twice since he came to Perelandra. Now on earth, thought Ransom, they'd soon discover how to breed these red hearts, and they'd cost a great deal more than the others. Money, in fact, would provide the means of saying encore in a voice that could not be disobeyed. When he had finished his meal, he went down to the water's edge to drink, but before he arrived there it was already up to the water's edge. The island at that moment was a little valley of bright land, nestling between hills of green water, and as he lay on his belly to drink, he had the extraordinary experience of dipping his mouth in a sea that was higher than the shore. Then he sat upright for a bit, with his legs dangling over the edge among the red weeds that fringed this little country. His solitude became a more persistent element in his consciousness. What had he been brought here to do? A wild fancy came into his head that this empty world had been waiting for him as for its first inhabitant, that he was singled out to be the founder, the beginner. It was strange that the utter loneliness through all these hours had not troubled him so much as one night of it on Malacandra. He thought the difference lay in this, that mere chance, or what he took for chance, had turned him adrift in Mars. But here he knew that he was part of a plan. He was no longer unattached, no longer on the outside. As his country climbed the smooth mountains of dimly lustrous water, he had frequent opportunity to see that many other islands were close at hand. They varied from his own island and from one another in their colouring more than he would have thought possible. It was a wonder to see these big mats or carpets of land tossing all around him like yachts in harbour on a rough day, their trees each moment at a different angle, just as the masts of the yachts would be. It was a wonder to see some edge of vivid green or velvety crimson come creeping over the top of a wave far above him, and then wait till the whole country unrolled itself down the wave's side for him to study. Sometimes his own land and a neighbouring land would be on opposite slopes of a trough, with only a narrow strait of water between them. and then, for a moment, you were cheated with the semblance of a terrestrial landscape. It looked exactly as though you were in a well-wooded valley with a river at the bottom of it. But while you watched, that seeming river did the impossible. It thrust itself up so that the land on either side sloped downwards from it, and then farther up still, and shouldered half the landscape out of sight beyond its ridge, and became a huge, greeny-gold hogsback of water hanging in the sky and threatening to engulf your own land, which now was concave and reeled backwards to the next roller, and rushing upwards became convex again. A clanging, whirring noise startled him. For a moment he fancied he was in Europe and that a plane was flying low over his head. Then he recognized his friend, the dragon. Its tail was streaked out straight behind it, so that it looked like a flying worm, and it was heading for an island about half a mile away. Following its course with his eyes, he saw two long lines of winged objects, dark against the gold firmament, approaching the same island from the left and the right. But they were not bat-winged reptiles. Peering hard into the distance, he decided that they were birds, and a musical chattering noise, presently wafted to him by a change of the wind, confirmed this belief. They must have been a little larger than swans. Their steady approach to the same island for which the dragon was heading fixed his attention and filled him with a vague feeling of expectation. What followed next raised this to positive excitement. He became aware of some creamily foamed disturbance in the water, much nearer, and making for the same island. A whole fleet of objects was moving in formation. He rose to his feet. Then the lift of a wave cut them off from his sight. Next moment they were visible again, hundreds of feet below him. Silver-coloured objects, all alive with circling and frisking movements. He lost them again and swore. In such a very uneventful world they had become important. Ah, here they were again. Fish, certainly. Very large, obese, dolphin-like fish, two long lines together, some of them spouting columns of rainbow-coloured water from their noses, and one leader. There was something queer about the leader, some sort of projection or malformation on the back. If only the things would remain visible for more than 50 seconds at a time. They had almost reached that other island now, and the birds were all descending to meet them at its edge. There was the leader again, with his hump or pillar on his back. A moment of wild incredulity followed, and then Ransom was balanced with legs wide apart on the utmost fringe of his own island and shouting for all he was worth. For at the very moment when the leading fish had reached that neighbouring land, the land had risen up on a wave between him and the sky, and he had seen, in perfect and unmistakable silhouette, the thing on the fish's back reveal itself as a human form. A human form which stepped ashore, turned with a slight inclination of its body towards the fish, and then vanished from sight as the whole island slid over the shoulder of the billow. With beating heart, Ransom waited till it was in view again. This time it was not between him and the sky. For a second or so the human figure was undiscoverable. A stab of something like despair pierced him. Then he picked it out again, a tiny, darkish shape moving slowly between him and a patch of blue vegetation. He waved and gesticulated and shouted till his throat was hoarse, but it took no notice of him. Every now and then he lost sight of it. Even when he found it again, he sometimes doubted whether it were not an optical illusion, some chance figuration of foliage which his intense desire had assimilated to the shape of a man. But always, just before he had despaired, it would become unmistakable again. Then his eyes began to grow tired, and he knew that the longer he looked, the less he would see. But he went on looking nonetheless. At last, from mere exhaustion, he sat down. The solitude, which up till now had been scarcely painful, had become a horror. Any return to it was a possibility he dared not face. The drugging and entrancing beauty had vanished from his surroundings. Take that one human form away, and all the rest of this world was now pure nightmare, a horrible cell or trap in which he was imprisoned. The suspicion that he was beginning to suffer from hallucinations crossed his mind. He had a picture of living forever and ever on this hideous island, always really alone, but always haunted by the phantoms of human beings who would come up to him with smiles and outstretched hands and then fade away as he approached them. Bowing his head on his knees, he set his teeth and endeavoured to restore some order in his mind. At first he found he was merely listening to his own breathing and counting the beats of his heart. But he tried again, and presently succeeded. And then, like revelation, came the very simple idea that if he wished to attract the attention of this man-like creature, he must wait till he was on the crest of a wave, and then stand up, so that it would see him outlined against the sky. 3 times he waited till the shore whereon he stood became a ridge, and rose, swaying to the movement of his strange country, gesticulating. 4th time he succeeded. The neighbouring island was, of course, lying for the moment beneath him like a valley. Quite unmistakably, the small dark figure waved back. It detached itself from a confusing background of greenish vegetation and began running towards him, that is, towards the nearer coast of its own island, across an orange-coloured field. It ran easily. The heaving surface of the field did not seem to trouble it. Then his own land reeled downwards and backwards, and a great wall of water pushed its way up between the 2 countries and cut each off from sight of the other. A moment later, and Ransom, from the valley in which he now stood, saw the orange-coloured land pouring itself like a moving hillside down the slightly convex slope of a wave far above him. The creature was still running. The width of water between the 2 islands was about 30 feet, and the creature was less than 100 yards away from him. He knew now that it was not merely man-like, but a man. A green man on an orange field, green like the beautifully coloured green beetle in an English garden, running downhill towards him with easy strides and very swiftly. Then the seas lifted his own land, and the green man became a foreshortened figure far below him, like an actor seen from the gallery at Covent Garden. Ransom stood on the very brink of his island, straining his body forward and shouting. The green man looked up. He was apparently shouting too, with his hands arched about his mouth. But the roar of the sea smothered the noise, and the next moment Ransom's island dropped into the trough of the wave, and the high green ridge of sea cut off his view. It was maddening. He was tortured with the fear that the distance between the islands might be increasing. Thank God, here came the orange land over the crest, following him down into the pit. And there was the stranger, now on the very shore, face to face with him. For 1 second the alien eyes looked at his, full of love and welcome. Then the whole face changed. A shock as of disappointment and astonishment passed over it. Ransom realized, not without a disappointment of his own, that he had been mistaken for someone else. The running, the waving, the shouts had not been intended for him. And the green man was not a man at all, but a woman. It is difficult to say why this surprised him so. Granted the human form, he was presumably as likely to meet a female as a male. But it did surprise him, so that only when the 2 islands once more began to fall apart into separate wave valleys did he realize that he had said nothing to her, but stood staring like a fool. And now that she was out of sight, he found his brain on fire with doubts. Was this what he had been sent to meet? He had been expecting wonders, had been prepared for wonders, but not prepared for a goddess, carved apparently out of green stone, yet alive. And then it flashed across his mind, he had not noticed it while the scene was before him, that she had been strangely accompanied. She had stood up amidst a throng of beasts and birds as a tall sapling stands among bushes, big pigeon-coloured birds and flame-coloured birds and dragons and beaver-like creatures about the size of rats, and heraldic-looking fish in the sea at her feet. Or had he imagined that? Was this the beginning of the hallucinations he had feared? Or another myth coming out into the world of fact? Perhaps a more terrible myth of Circe or Alcina? And the expression on her face, what had she expected to find that made the finding of him such a disappointment? The other island became visible again. He had been right about the animals. They surrounded her 10 or 20 deep, all facing her, most of them motionless, but some of them finding their places, as at a ceremony, with delicate, noiseless movements. The birds were in long lines, and more of them seemed to be alighting on the island every moment and joining these lines. From a wood of bubble trees behind her, 6 creatures like very short-legged and elongated pigs, the dachshunds of the pig world, were waddling up to join the assembly. Tiny frog-like beasts, like those he had seen falling in the rain, kept leaping about her, sometimes higher than her head, sometimes alighting on her shoulders. Their colours were so vivid that at first he mistook them for kingfishers. Amidst all this she stood looking at him, her feet together, her arms hanging at her sides, her stare level and unafraid, communicating nothing. Ransom determined to speak, using the old solar tongue. "I am from another world," he began, and then stopped. The Green Lady had done something for which he was quite unprepared. She raised her arm and pointed at him, not as in menace, but as though inviting the other creatures to behold him. At the same moment her face changed again, and for a second he thought she was going to cry. Instead, she burst into laughter, peal upon peal of laughter, till her whole body shook with it, till she bent almost double, with her hands resting on her knees, still laughing and repeatedly pointing at him. The animals, like our own dogs in similar circumstances, dimly understood that there was merriment afoot. All manner of gambolling, wing-clapping, snorting, and standing upon hind legs began to be displayed. And still the Green Lady laughed, till yet again the wave divided them, and she was out of sight. Ransom was thunderstruck. Had the Eldela sent him to meet an idiot, or an evil spirit that mocked men? Or was it, after all, a hallucination? For this was just how a hallucination might be expected to behave. Then an idea occurred to him which would have taken much longer, perhaps, to occur to me or you. It might not be she who was mad, but he who was ridiculous. He glanced down at himself. Certainly his legs presented an odd spectacle, for one was brownish-red, like the flanks of a Titian satyr, and the other was white, by comparison almost a leprous white. As far as self-inspection could go, he had the same parti-coloured appearance all over, no unnatural result of his one-sided exposure to the sun during the voyage. Had this been the joke? He felt a momentary impatience with the creature who could mar the meeting of two worlds with laughter at such a triviality. Then he smiled in spite of himself at the very undistinguished career he was having on Perelandra. For dangers he had been prepared, but to be first a disappointment and then an absurdity. Hello, here were the lady and her island in sight again. She had